Beloved listeners, I'm going to take you on a tour of the House of Government. This is a real building that still stands in Moscow across the river from the Kremlin. It also doubles as the title of a remarkable and disturbing book. It is a saga of the Russian Revolution of 1917, told through the letters, diaries, poems, stories of the residents of the House of Government. It's the tale of literary-obsessed romantic revolutionaries, of such transcendent zeal that it takes on the quality of religious fervour, who for decades had plotted in exile or prison, hoping that one day, their dream of overturning the Tsarist monarchy and establishing a golden utopia for workers and peasants would come true. Okay, they succeeded in destroying the monarchy, but they did not succeed in creating that golden utopia. Historian Yuri Sleskin says the Bolsheviks were a millenarian sect formed in the expectation of world revolution. Yuri is professor of history at the University of California in Berkeley and joins us from his home. Yuri, thanks for coming on my little wireless program and congratulations on your epic book.
Well, thank you and thank you for having me.
You grew up in Moscow. Were you aware of the existence of the House of Government as a child?
Yes, I didn't know it used to be called the House of Government. It wasn't really called anything in particular when I was a child. But I knew of it, as I think most Muscovites did, as a huge, gray, menacing-looking building diagonally across the river from the Kremlin, a building covered with memorial plaques dedicated to various revolutionaries. So that's how I knew it before Yuri Trifonov's novella The House on the Embankment was published in the 1970s. And then I learned a great deal more about it. And since then, I have known it, and most Muscovites, indeed most Russians, know it as the House on the Embankment. It ever since it has been an iconic building in Moscow and in Russian history.
Well, it's described by you as the largest residential building in Europe, a model of socialist domesticity, 550 fully furnished family apartments, public spaces, a cafeteria, grocery store, walk-in clinic, childcare center, hairdresser's salon, on and on the list goes, a movie theater, a tennis court.
It was designed, conceived as a place for party and state officials to live and to share their free moments. So all those spaces, playing tennis and chess and volleyball and music and for shooting, playing, dancing, and so on, were meant to be communal. And so in that sense, it was meant as a prototype.
And little did the happy occupants know or realize that it would become a place of overwhelming tragedy, but that comes later. You discuss the physical characteristics of the location of the building on a swamp, and there used to be lots of factories. It was important for you to tell us the prehistory?
Yes, because it is, I think, a perfect metaphor for what happened. Draining the swamp, creating a new resplendent building, an eternal building, as some of them called it, in what used to be a swamp. And it so happens that that district on an island in downtown Moscow was known as a swamp. It still is. And that metaphor for the old society, for Babylon, comparing it to a swamp, was exceedingly common among the Bolsheviks. So that's at the center of the story, a key theme in my book, the swamp on the one hand and the eternal house or the House of Government on the other.
Yuri, do you reckon your story about the House of Government has any urgent relevance for people living in Putin's Russia?
I didn't think about this when I set out to write it. I wasn't thinking about it when I was writing it. But I think it will be, and I'm now working on the Russian version, which I think should have come first, but here I am. So, you know, you get the, as it were, the translation before the Russians get the original.
Don't worry, Yuri, all the listeners are familiar with the Cyrillic alphabet.
Good. So anyway, so I think that this book will be of interest to a lot of Russian readers, who, many of whom, don't really know what to make of the revolution. So here we are celebrating or marking 100th anniversary of the revolution. And very few people in Russia know what it is that they're celebrating. There is no consensus on what it means, on what Bolshevism represents. There are certain people who think of the socialist October Revolution as a tragedy. Some think of it as a noble attempt to build a new world. But most don't know what to think. And there is certainly no official line on the meaning and significance of the revolution. And so I hope that my book will make people think about the revolution and about how it began and how it ended, will humanize the Bolsheviks and would, you know, make the revolution less of a sort of set, you know, less of a symbol or set of symbols, and more a story of people with certain beliefs who lived their lives and built their lives sort of within that belief and with that belief, and then were killed in some ways by the state that they created.
Yuri, you've got a familiar disclaimer at the beginning of your book, which in the circumstances I find somewhat enigmatic. This is a work of history. Any resemblance to fictional characters, dead or alive, is entirely coincidental.
Well, it refers to, first of all, to my conceit, and then to some degree to the book's subject. It is indeed a work of history, but it is structured as a novel, with various themes, motifs, metaphors, and characters connected in a variety of ways on different planes. It is also true that literature is a character in its own right and a very important part of the story that I tell in the book. Most of my characters, most of the so-called old Bolsheviks, the revolutionaries, loved literature, spent hours of their lives, especially when they were in prison and in exile, reading, taught their children literature and about literature, and taught them the fact, or rather passed on their belief, that there were few things in life more important than reading. And so not only is it a theme in the book, not only is it important was it important for the revolutionaries, but it is also something that I discuss, Soviet literature, as it tried to sort of embody and represent the revolutionary experiment.
One of my regular guests is our mutual friend Sheila Fitzpatrick, Yuri.
Mm-hmm.
As well as making the linkage to War and Peace, she also thinks the book has more of a sense of the Gulag Archipelago.
Well, I'm not sure what she meant by that, but I think she was referring not so much to the subject, although there are similarities in that my book ends, or rather many of my characters end in the Gulag, or end up in the Gulag, but about the genre. Book that is documentary, that has footnotes, that is about history and about facts, but has a certain literary ambition or quality to it. Mine is obviously very different from Solzhenitsyn's in its design, its goals, indeed its genre. But I think Sheila Fitzpatrick was referring to this peculiar combination of sort of the historical and the literary.
Are you embarrassed by the fact that almost every reviewer compares it favorably with Tolstoy's War and Peace?
Well, not altogether favorably. It is a bit embarrassing, though, in any case. But it is true, on the other hand, that I did mean to write an epic. Comparing it to War and Peace is extravagant, but noticing that it is an epic is, I think, appropriate.
Let's talk about some of the emotions that flow through the book. You have described it in some ways as a love story, and you write that revolution was inseparable from love.
Right. And that has to do with, first of all, the power of the emotion, the intensity of the feeling among the Bolsheviks, and with the fact that most early Bolsheviks, virtually all of them, were young men in love with the revolution, with the idea of the revolution, and with particularly young women who represented it. And so my book is a story of how they fell in love, how they were happy in love, and then about the tragedy of the end of love, since the way the revolution ended was echoed, in a sense, in the way the story of their love, of their particular the love stories, ended as well.
Yuri, what I'd like to do is riffle through the book and point my finger at some of the characters. And yes, mm-hmm. Let the record show, dear listener, that Yuri has at least as many as Tolstoy. And one of the most interesting, I think, dies before the House of Government was built. Tell me about Yakov Sverdlov.
He was the first head of the Soviet state. He was the most important party secretary in the history of the party before Stalin. He was the organizer of the Communist Party. But before then, he was a voracious reader, by all accounts, a charming young man who joined the Bolsheviks as a schoolboy, and who was a source of inspiration for his friends and lovers, who also happened to be a very eloquent writer of letters, love letters among them, a man of tremendous, I think, insight and introspection, self-reflexive and intelligent, a man who also launched and organized the Red Terror during the Civil War, and the execution of the Tsar's family, who came to represent Bolshevik toughness. That sad-eyed Jewish young man would, in his incarnation as a leather-clad commissar, become the ultimate symbol of toughness.
Well, one of the reasons that he's interesting is because he's also perhaps the ultimate symbol of what you're talking about, the connection between revolution and love. Specifically, I'm thinking about his relationship with Kira Egon Besser.
There is no evidence that they were lovers, but his letters to her are tender letters from an older man to a young woman, from a mentor to a disciple. However we define them, but love letters one way or another, expressing tenderness for her and love for the revolution and the hope that the two would eventually come together. But I think what's interesting about him is this combination of him as the author of those letters, as somebody associated with love, and then Sverdlov as the man who presides over the dissolution of the Constituent Assembly, who inaugurates Bolshevism and symbolizes toughness. It's not just the former, but the combination of the tenderness and eventually that toughness that I think characterizes him and makes him important in the story. Another thing that makes him important is that he had a son, and his son, who actually lived in the House of Government, Sverdlov himself, died before the house was built. But his son lived in that house, and he was a secret police official and an informer. And his specialty within the secret police was to form fictitious counter-revolutionary organizations and use his childhood friends, people his age from the House of Government, as those to frame and to recruit and later betray. So it is a story of several generations. Just again, if we are to dwell a little bit more on the Sverdlov family, his brother left Russia, fought in the French Foreign Legion, and became a French diplomat, high official, and a close associate of General de Gaulle.
Yuri, as a very young communist in Australia, I was overwhelmed by the realization that the party I had joined had eerie parallels with a religious organization. Now, you go far further and deeper than this because you give an overview of religious fundamentalist movements active at the time and how they are echoed and perhaps even intensified by the Bolsheviks as a faith-based millenarian movement.
It's important for me not to draw a stark line between what is religion and what is not religion, or to ask questions about whether there is such a thing as a secular religion. What is important to me is that there is such a thing as millenarianism, which is to say a belief in the millennium, which comes after an apocalypse, violent overthrow of the world as we know it, the end and the destruction of Babylon, however represented. So in other words, millenarianism is a belief, as defined by many scholars, that the world as we know it will end violently in our lifetimes. And so by that definition, early Christianity, Mormonism, early Rastafarianism, Jim Jones and the People's Temple, Khmer Rouge, and many, many others were millenarian movements. And so was Bolshevism. Most of my characters, and this really struck me when I was reading their letters, diaries, early speeches, but particularly their personal documents, by how frequently they refer to their faith, by the intensity of their faith, by their belief that truly everything corrupt, everything evil would be gone forever, and gone forever as a result of this revolution in their lifetimes, or at the latest during their children's lifetimes.
Of course, this is an absolute heretical notion to any Soviet communist, because they had to see themselves as rationalist, anti-religious, religion being the opium of the people. Or did some of them sense this at the time?
Well, they would certainly distinguish between obsolete and incorrect faiths and their own, which was, of course, based in reality and was a prediction as opposed to a prophecy. But many of them would not have objected to the term faith. They used it a lot. They supported each other by talking about it, by saying, you know, don't lose faith. I have this shining, luminous faith. It was all over Bolshevik literature and their personal correspondence, much of which was confessional.
In Australia, the labor movement uses as a rhetorical device the image of the light on the hill, which reminds me, of course, that right across the political spectrum, from the fascist to the communists, there is a confusion of terminology with ideas you find in theology.
Right. But I think it is important. The reason I call the Bolsheviks millenarians is because they did not use those terms as metaphors, the way we all do, right? And as you say, the way politicians do all the time, and perhaps especially politicians in America, where I live now. They quite literally, I think, meant that most of the things we associate with the world in which we live will be radically transformed in their lifetimes as a result of what they called an unheard of revolution, global violent cataclysm. So there were obviously, they were using metaphors and familiar metaphors from the Old Testament and the Christian gospel, but they were also serious about these things happening in their lives, partly as a result of their own actions, and partly because they were predicted by the founders. So it was a combination. They were that revolution and communism that was to follow were both inevitable and brought about by the revolution.
This is LNL, or as I often jokingly call it, Leninel, and I'm talking to Yuri Slezkin on the House of Government. Let's move on to December the 1st, 1934, when one of the people in residence, a young Khrushchev, gets a call that changes the lives of all the distinguished residents in the building. What was the message?
The message was that Comrade Kirov had been assassinated in Leningrad. And that message would reverberate through those people's lives all the way to their graves. That is something that so many of them, so many of the survivors would remember as a turning point. It's actually not easy to explain why, not only after the fact, but at the time in some of the diaries and letters, they pointed to that day, to that message, as fateful, as deeply meaningful, as frightening. But it is true that that's how they reacted. And it is also true that it was a sort of prologue to the story of what would become known as the Great Terror.
So here's a moment where the old Bolsheviks become the targets of their own terror. And you say that nights with fewer than 100 executions were rare.
At the height of the terror in 1937-38, there were arrests every night within the building. And then most of the people arrested inside that building would be executed in the same, essentially, two locations in the same way, by a shot in the back of the head.
Yet one of the most amazing aspects of the purges you describe, using letters, diaries, is the reaction of many of the people arrested in that they did not question their political ideals.
It's actually not that easy to define, because they, on the one hand, they thought of themselves as innocent. They didn't think of themselves as counter-revolutionaries. They certainly didn't think of themselves as having betrayed the revolution in any literal sense, in having conspired against the government or having planned to assassinate Comrade Stalin and his associates. At the same time, many of them did feel guilty, did feel that their life inside the House of Government had been a kind of betrayal of the revolution, that life had been in some ways bourgeois, or had become so in spite of their best efforts, or perhaps because of their inability to come to terms with domesticity. So it varied from one sort of victim to another, and from one family to another. But few people, I think, consider themselves entirely free of guilt.
Yuri, so, you reminded us earlier on that the House of mm-hmm. Government became better known as the House on the Embankment. Who's in it now? Is it occupied by Putin's officials, or has it been turned into condos by an oligarch?
It is popular among people who can afford to live in the very center of Moscow, many of them with the view of the Kremlin. Some of the residents are the grandchildren of the original inhabitants who survived the purges. But most have moved there since the terror, including those who moved there in the 90s and since the 90s. And they are part, at least in part, a new Russian elite, entrepreneurs, company CEOs, as well as some foreign correspondents, company officials, and so on. So it is a prestigious piece of real estate, as well as still a very imposing work of architecture.
Although the air around and within is full of ghosts. Now, the last section of your book is really about the children of the revolutionaries, and there you point to one of the big problems for the Bolshevik utopia, that the kids lost the faith.
Right. Well, arguably, they never had. They admired their parents, especially their fathers, because most of the fathers were executed. And many of the mothers who were executed would later be sent into exile and come back sick, aged, unwanted, and unloved. The children loved their fathers, admired them, but did not share their faith.
Well, they weren't rather, millenarians, as you point out, but then very few millenarians extend beyond one generation.
Right. And I think the greatest challenge for any millenarian movement is to justify, to explain, or to explain away, if you will, the failure of the prophecy. To learn how to live with the fact that the prophecy never came true. And by definition, since the world is still here, and it's still imperfect, we still live in Babylon, all this means that all the millenarian prophecies from Jesus of Nazareth to Jim Jones have so far failed. And so the greatest challenge for any millenarian movement is to deal with that circumstance, to bridge that gap, to create institutions that would transform this fervent expectation of an imminent transformation into a never-ending, routinized expectation. And so the Bolsheviks failed at that. They were incredibly successful in that they actually conquered Babylon, and arguably were the only millenarians who did at the height of their faith, but they didn't last like so many, like indeed most millenarian movements, they didn't last beyond one generation, or rather the faith did not. And so the children who grew up in that house were good Soviets, were patriotic Soviets, many of them, very many indeed, died during the Great Patriotic War, including those whose fathers and mothers had been arrested. But they weren't millenarians, and they weren't really even communists. And I think the reason they weren't is to be found inside those apartments.
One of the people that lived inside the apartments was Tanya Miyakova, mm-hmm. and her story has a great poignancy. Share that with us.
Yes, she was a true believer. She was a Bolshevik, but she was a heretic. She became a Trotskyite, was exiled to Kazakhstan, then released, spent some time just a few months in the House of Government, was rearrested, exiled again, and again, and again. And the whole time she was in prison or in exile, she kept writing to her family, to her mother, her husband, and her daughter. And her letters are, I think, remarkably eloquent, and also remarkably, I think, revealing about the Bolsheviks, about people her generation, about people of her faith. She remained a true believer until, or almost until the end. And in her letters, she tried to reconcile her, and speaking again about love, her love for her husband, her love for her daughter and her mother, and her love for the Soviet state, the Soviet experiment, and for the revolution. How much of that exchange was meant for the censor, we will never know. But based on what I know about the other residents and what they had to say and to write, I believe that it was a genuine agony and a genuine dilemma for her, and that she lived with that and struggled with that as she moved from one prison cell or apartment somewhere in Siberia and Kazakhstan to another. And I probably shouldn't tell you. I hope that some of your listeners will read the book. And even though I suppose the ending is predictable, I would rather they read about it in the book, because it is not entirely predictable, shall we say.
Yuri, it's been marvelous to talk to you. Yuri Slinsky is professor of history at the University of California, and The House of Government, His Saga of the Russian Revolution, is published by Princeton University Press. Come back and we'll do the whole thing again in Russian.
Thank you very much. Обязательно сделаю.